We are continuing today our study in the book of Hosea. And once again, the bulletin is going to be a little bit askew because in looking back over it, since chapter 3 is so small, we are going to do chapter 2 and chapter 3 of Hosea today. And if you'll remember from last week, we talked about who Hosea was. He was a contemporary of Isaiah. But chances are, once again, scholars debate this, but chances are that as Isaiah was prophesying to the southern kingdom of Judah, Hosea was prophesying to the northern kingdom of Israel. And so there are some particular tidbits in Hosea that refer to the northern kingdom. But yet still you could see in Hosea's writing that he still had in mind the whole unified Jewish people and not just the northern kingdom. So in the first chapter, God had asked Hosea to take a wife of ill repute and have two children with that wife. And the middle of chapter 1, talked about God's judgment and how it would be declared, the children would be named Not My People, and the other child would be named No Compassion, as symbolic of what God's attitude towards them was going to be because of all their idolatries. But it ended chapter 1 with a note of hope, of restoration, that at one point there would be gathered back together the peoples and there would be restoration unto God. So in chapter 2, starting in verse 1, say to your brothers Ami and to your sisters Ruhamah. So rather than Not My People and No Compassion, now the children are renamed My People and Compassion upon restoration. Contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband, and let her put away her harlotry from her face, and her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked, and expose her as on the day when she was born. I will also make her like a wilderness, make her like desert land, and slay her with thirst. Also I will have no compassion on her children, because they are children of harlotry, for their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her, so that she cannot find her paths. She will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them, and she will seek them, but will not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. Sometimes, sin has to run its course, where people step off into sinfulness and they're not willing to listen. That's sort of the intent in Matthew 18. After you pursue them for a while and they still don't want to listen and they head off, then you let them go. You set them out. And God sort of used this technique with the children of Israel, that as they were going after idols, as they were going after other gods, then God just simply let them go. This bit about hedging her way with thorns and building a wall against her, that God made life difficult for her in terms of the nation of Israel. God made life difficult so that they would come back and trust in the Lord once again. In our Haftarah reading this morning, we were in the book of Judges, chapter 11, and the whole story of the book of Judges is the story of this progression of people's lives with God. That they would follow the Lord blessed them, they became prosperous, they became powerful. So they began to say, this is my own hand that did this, or these other gods that did this for me. And they start walking away from God, and God brought trouble. The trouble caused the people to turn back to Him. They turned back to Him in faith. God rose up a deliverer, raised up a deliverer, who then fought for the people, who overcame their oppressors, and so the people became strong and prosperous, and the whole cycle went round and round and round for 400 years. Happens in our own lives, doesn't it? That we get strong and we get in times of plenty and times of happiness, that can be a far greater temptation than times of difficulty. In times of difficulty, especially for someone who is a believer, a time of difficulty can be a time of drawing closer to God, a time of prayer, a time of understanding, a time of really diving into God's Word for comfort and for understanding, for counsel. What do I do now? How do I get out of this? How do I deal with the situation? Time of prosperity is a time to worry about. Because in times of prosperity, when things are easy and things are good, it's tempted to walk away, go off and do other things. Verse 8, "For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal." Isn't that a testimony to God's grace? As the in the book of Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, Yeshua uses that as an illustration how we ought to treat people, that Yeshua said, God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. So God, in His great mercy and His grace, continued up to this point to give unto His people prosperity, and they turned around and gave it to the Baals, gave it to the other gods that they were serving. It's a rather heinous thing. It's like a husband giving his wife a beautiful piece of jewelry and her going out and selling it to buy drugs. I mean, it's that awful a thing that God was lavishing on His beloved all these wonderful things, and instead they turned around and gave it to false gods who are all around. Verse 9, "Therefore I will take back my grain at harvest time, my new wine at season. I will also take away my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. And then I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. I will also put an end to all her gaiety, her feasts, her new moons, her Shabbats, and all her festal assemblies. I will destroy her vines and fig trees, of which she said, 'These are my wages, which my lovers have given me.' I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field will devour them. I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them, and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry, and follow her lovers, so that she forgot me, declares the Lord." So God was going to bring judgment, first of all, in verse 10, in terms of her reputation. Going to bring humiliation. In verse 11, He was going to put an end to her joy and to this hypocritical worship. He's just simply going to take it away. And finally, He's going to remove her prosperity, all the vines and fig trees, so that finally she'd be left with nothing. Nothing left at the end. That sort of is kind of the way that the progression of consequences for sin occurs even today, isn't it? That it begins with, you know, that there's humiliation and sadness. Then finally you just drop all the pretenses of pretending to follow God. And finally, as the sin continues, it results in devastation. Devastation of personal life, devastation all around. Verse 14, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her. Then I will give her her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi, and will no longer call me Baali." Ishi means my husband. Baali means my Lord. It's kind of interesting, though, even today in Israel, when women refer to their husband, they refer to them as Baali. That's the colloquial term for my husband. So, but I don't know of anyone who refers to the Lord by that name. Verse 17, "For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, so that they will be mentioned by their names no more." In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land, and I will make them lie down in safety. From Hosea's time until today, which was approximately 2,700 years, 2,600 years, this prophecy has not been fulfilled. That the land of Israel has been a land that has been a land in turmoil. It was a land in turmoil when the Romans came through. It's been a land of turmoil ever since. It's a land of turmoil today. You can look at the events in the news, and you don't say to yourself when you see the reports from the land of Israel and its neighbors that there is a peaceful land with no threat of war whatsoever. Rather, you see a land balanced on the edge of a knife, constantly in peril, armed soldiers everywhere. So this is referring to something that is not only in Jeremiah's future, I'm sorry, not only in Hosea's future, but also in our future. I don't remember if we did verse 19, but verse 9, I will betroth you to me forever. Yeah, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in loving kindness and in compassion. And I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know the Lord. Not know of the Lord, not tell stories, but know Him personally. It will come about in that day that I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the heavens, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, to the new wine, and to the oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will sow her for myself in the land. I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. I will say to those who are not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. So that is the marriage of the unfaithful wife back again to God. And here's talking about Israel. The remarriage of Israel unto God. Unto God. Chapter 3, then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley, which is cheap price for a slave in those days. And I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you. The sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they will come trembling to the Lord and to His goodness in the last days. So there is going to be a final restoration, as Romans, book of Romans says, that all Israel shall be saved when we come back together. So what in the world, we're reading this and we're saying, well, we don't have any idols, so how in the world does this pertain to us in our land? We have not been unfaithful unto God. Well, if you were saying that, you would of course be wrong. Even the secular press is speaking about this being as a post-Christian world. They're referring to that primarily in Europe. Europe is maybe a generation ahead of us for some reason in terms of falling from the Lord. But America is not far behind. I was trying to think last week after, you know, after the main part of the service when we were talking question and answers, we were talking about, well, what are the idols that people are setting up? And we talked about some things that people set up. Paganism is an issue in America, but it is not as big an issue as I had thought it was. As I started looking at what the frequency of people who are actually consider themselves part of the neo-pagan groups, things like, you know, Wicca and those sorts of things, they're actually a very small proportion of America. They're worldwide, the amount of practitioners of Wicca at this particular juncture is under a million people worldwide. And in America, it is much smaller than that. I think we might be seeing a little bit of a skew because in metropolitan areas, that would tend to be more prevalent. So in places like the Baltimore area, you would see more of that than you would, say, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Topeka, Kansas, or places out in the Midwest. You probably wouldn't see very much of neo-paganism at all. So we're maybe a little bit skewed. So what in the world is the problem that is driving us to the point where we need, like the ancient Jewish people, to be restored unto God? I think one of the keys of what's going on is in 1933, there are a group of people who gathered together to issue something called the Humanist Manifesto. And they updated that in 1973 to Humanist Manifesto 2, and then there was a Humanist Manifesto 3. And these are not people of little influence. The list of signers to this Humanist Manifesto are people like Isaac Asimov, who is a famous science fiction author, Edward Dere, who is one of the powers that be in the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the president of Planned Parenthood of America, the rabbi who is the founder of the Jewish Reconstructionist Movement, the chairman of the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, the rabbi who is the director of the Society for Humanistic Judaism, and the names go on and on. People who are teaching in universities, university professors, it is chock full of that. So what in the world does this thing have to say, and how is this related to idolatry? This thing goes on and on, but I just wanted to read a couple of sections from it. The preface says, as in 1933, humanists still believe that traditional theism, especially faith in the prayer-hearing God, assumed to live and care for persons, to hear and understand their prayers, and to be able to do something about them, is an unproved and outmoded faith. Salvationism, based on mere affirmation, still appears as harmful, diverting people with false hopes of heaven hereafter. Reasonable minds look to other means for survival. I'm going to skip around in it. The next century can be and should be the humanistic century. He's talking about our current century. Dramatic scientific, technological, and ever-accelerating social and political changes crowd our awareness. We have virtually conquered the planet, explored the moon, overcome the natural limits of travel and communication. We stand at the dawn of a new age, ready to move farther into space and perhaps inhabit other planets. Using technology wisely, we can control our environment, conquer poverty, markedly reduce disease, extend our lifespan, significantly modify our behavior, alter the course of human evolution and cultural development, unlock vast new powers, and provide mankind with unparalleled opportunity for achieving an abundant, meaningful life. Traditional moral codes and newer irrational cults both fail to meet the pressing needs of today and tomorrow. False theologies of hope and messianic ideologies, substituting new dogmas for old, cannot cope with existing world realities. They separate rather than unite people. In the best sense, religion may inspire dedication to the highest ethical ideals. The cultivation of moral devotion and creative imagination is an expression of genuine spiritual experience and aspiration. We believe, however, that traditional dogmatic or authoritarian religions that place revelation, God, ritual, or creed above human needs and experience do a disservice to the human species. Any account of nature should pass the test of scientific evidence. In our judgment, the dogmas and myths of traditional religions do not do so. Even at this late date in human history, certain elementary facts based upon the critical use of scientific reason have to be restated. We find insufficient evidence for belief in the existence of a supernatural. It is either meaningless or irrelevant to the question of survival and fulfillment of the human race. As non-theists, we begin with humans, not God, nature, not deity. Nature may indeed be broader and deeper than we now know. Any new discoveries, however, will but enlarge our knowledge of the natural. Promises of immortal salvation or fear of eternal damnation are both illusionary and harmful. They distract humans from present concerns, from self-actualization, and from rectifying social injustices. And it goes on and on and on. So I think that's problem number one. Problem number one in terms of idolatry, that our particular idol that most of the people who hold control over directing kind of the currents of the society and educating the next generation, Their God is humanity. Their God is humanity. Because of the progress that we have made scientifically, these people are encouraged to raise the created up as the God of this world, and they see the universe as a human-centered universe. In so doing, you know, in a game, that when somebody moves out of bounds, you throw a flag down on the play. In this case, these people are definitely out of bounds. After having read that, and this is not my whole purpose for reading this, it is to concentrate on idolatry and how to keep ourselves separate from it. But many of the things they said, of course, are false. God cannot be proven scientifically, but then I cannot prove that there is a, that I drove down Reisterstown Road this morning scientifically. I just can't. It's outside the realm of science to prove that. You have to go to judicial rules instead of scientific rules. And looking at it by judicial rules of evidence, the things that God has done in history is eminently reasonable. It's eminently reasonable. And if science is dedicated to understanding the natural and the seen world, then for science to say that there is no unseen world is once again a flag on the play, because science is not equipped to deal with what cannot be seen. All of science is based on the observable. Science does a great job on the observable. My, you know, secular career is based around the pursuit of things that are scientific. And when science stays in its boundary, then science does its job. It's sort of like, you know, this last week there was a story on one of these news magazines about a 500-pound bear that got out of its house. You know, this man was keeping it in a cage or whatever in the house. It got out of the house and into the neighbor's house and tore up the woman in the other house. That's what science is like. So long as science stays in its house and in its cage, it's good and it's effective and it serves its purpose. But if you let science out of its cage so that it goes places where it is not designed to go, it winds up somewhere else and causes great damage. So the first thing that we have to worry about or be concerned about or have our eyes open to in our culture in terms of idolatry, in terms of being seduced away from God, in terms of what these people were saying, that their own gods provided everything. You listen to what the humanists had to say about where all the blessings came from. They're saying all the blessings, all the achievements, came from the hand of man rather than from God. I mean, just, you look at that and you just shake your head, because all it would take is a rock the size of a tractor trailer truck hurled at particular precision and accuracy towards one of our major cities, and there would be nothing left of a large portion of that city. So for mankind, who is so weak and so powerless, you raise the temperature of this world. You know, all this bit about global warming, and I don't want to get into a debate about this reality or not, but all of the great disasters that are foretold means are coming from a raise of the temperature of the planet by like 5 degrees, 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And that would be enough to cause widespread catastrophe. How arrogant are we to say to God, thank you, but we don't need you anymore, we're powerful enough to do this on our own, and then the next breath say that a 10-degree rise in temperatures will wreak havoc upon our world. 10 degrees is not a lot of temperature rise. We are just so very, very delicate creatures. And God has done so very much for us. But, like Hosea says, we are taking those blessings that He has given to us and ascribing it to our gods, which are our own strength and our own wisdom. And all this stuff is showing up in the churches into confusion and strife. I'm debating whether to read this or not. I'm not going to read it. In adult class, you can read it. But someone writing, there's a website called Apostasy Alert. And it talks about all the spiritual unrest that's going on and all the things that are going on and all the people who've gotten it wrong. That in the church, we're not only worshiping human potential, which is this humanism thing, but we're also worshiping the signs of God's action rather than God Himself. And we are craving the experience rather than craving the fellowship. And that's what this particular article is about. And in so doing, that we're worshiping a God that is not the God of the Bible. Not the God of the Bible. So what are we as individuals to do about it? Well, this whole process that God was taking disobedient Israel through is the same process that we talk about every month from 1 Corinthians 11. That process that if we do not listen to God in the prosperous times, He takes us through the hard times so we learn to trust Him again. That's the first lesson we need to learn individually. The second lesson we need to learn is we need to look around at the culture all about us. If this truly is a post-Christian world, a post-Christian culture, and really there's no such thing as a post-Christian culture because God will take His measures to bring the whole world in submission to Him. So we might be in an interlude when the world has fallen away from God, but it's not post-Christian. But in that midst of things, we always have to remember, as people around us are ascribing things to all of the their own hands and all the things they did, to remember to give the glory back to God. Glory back to God. I can remember when I was speaking to a family member about giving money to God. Their response was, you know, and I said, I'm not giving money to God that He hasn't given to me first. This was a number of years ago, and the family member responded, well, it was your own hand who did that. How can you say God did that? And the response is, well, God gave me the strength. I was born into a prosperous society, and I have the strength and the knowledge and the opportunities to make that kind of wealth and give it back to God. There is no such thing as a self-made man or woman. God made us all. God made the universe in which we live. And everything belongs to Him. He has supplied us all the prosperity from His hand. And we should never ascribe it to the created rather than the creator and give glory to anything else for having given it to us. I mean, yeah, sure, somebody gives you a lot of money, you thank them. But remember in your mind that it is God who has created all of it and God who has arranged to give it to you. That it is not the case that we as human beings are evolving, as humanists say, to the point where we don't need God anymore, but rather we are a bunch of very weak but very prosperous people who need God even more, because the big danger here is prosperity and falling away from God in the midst of it. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, thank You very much for all that You have given to us. Thank You for supplying us not just the bare minimums, but abundantly. Thank You for all the ways You have supplied us spiritually with shelves upon shelves of books about You, with seminars and tapes and radio programs and even television programs in some places, all speaking about You. My Father, in the midst of all that, we are still very weak and corrupt people. And we very much need to renounce the evil deeds and the fruitless deeds that we spend so much time in. Father, open up our eyes that we might see, that we might understand Your will for us, that we might understand what purity really means, that we might come unto You wholeheartedly and not half-heartedly and receive Your cleansing and walk close to you in obedience and holiness for the glory of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.